I say again, what is needed on your planet is a massive shift in consciousness, a change in your awareness, a renewed respect for all of life, and a deepened understanding of the interrelatedness of everything.
Well, you're God. If you don't want things to where they are, why don't you change them?
As I've explained to you before, my decision from the beginning has been to give you the freedom to create your life, and hence yourself, as you wish to be. You cannot know yourself as the creator if I tell you what to create, how to create, and then force, require, or cause you to do so. If I do that, my purpose is lost. But now, let us just notice what has been created on your planet and see if it doesn't make you a bit indignant. Let's look at just four inside pages of one of your major daily newspapers on a typical day. Pick up today's paper.
Okay, it's Saturday, April 9th, 1994, and I'm looking at the San Francisco Chronicle.
Good. Open it to any page.
All right, here's page A7.
Fine. What do you see there?
Well, the headline says, Developing Nations to Discuss Labor Rights.
Excellent. Go on.
The story reports on what it calls an old schism between industrialized nations and developing nations over labor rights. Leaders of some developing nations are said to be, quote, fearful that a campaign to expand labor rights could create a backdoor means of barring their low-wage products from the rich nation's consumer markets, close quote. It goes on to say that negotiators for Brazil, Malaysia, India, Singapore, and other developing nations have refused to establish a permanent committee of the World Trade Organization which would be charged with drafting a labor rights policy.
What rights is the story talking about?
It says basic rights for workers, such as prohibitions on forced labor, establishment of workplace safety standards, and a guarantee of the opportunity to bargain collectively.
And why do developing nations not want such rights as part of an international agreement? I'll tell you why. But first, let's get clear that it's not the workers in those countries who resist such rights. Those negotiators for the developing nations are the same people, or are closely allied with the same people, who own and run the factories. In other words, the rich and powerful. As in the days before the labor movement in America, those are the people now benefiting from the mass exploitation of workers. You can be sure that they are being quietly assisted by big money in the U.S. and other rich nations, where industrialists, no longer able to unfairly exploit workers in their own nations, are subcontracting to factory owners in these developing countries for building their own plants there in order to exploit foreign workers who are still unprotected from being used by others to increase their already obscene profits.
But the story says it's our government, the present administration, which is pushing for workers' rights to be part of a worldwide trade agreement.
Your current leader, Bill Clinton, is a man who believes in basic workers' rights, even if your powerful industrialists don't. He is courageously fighting big money's vested interest. Other American presidents and leaders throughout the world have been killed for less.
Are you saying President Clinton is going to be murdered?
Well, let's just say there are going to be tremendous powers attempting to remove him from office. They've got to get him out of there just as they had to remove John Kennedy 30 years earlier. Like Kennedy before him, Bill Clinton is doing everything big money hates. Not only pressing for workers' rights worldwide, but siding with the little person over the entrenched establishment on virtually every social question. He believes it's the right of every person, for instance, to have access to adequate health care. Whether or not he or she can afford to pay the exorbitant prices and fees that America's medical community has come to enjoy. He has said these costs have got to come down. That has not made him very popular with another very large segment of America's rich and powerful, from pharmaceutical manufacturers to insurance conglomerates, from medical corporations to business owners having to provide decent coverage for their workers. A great many people who are now making a lot of money are going to have to make a little bit less if America's poor are to be given universal health care. This is not making Mr. Clinton the most popular man in town. at least not among certain elements who have already proven in this century that they have the ability to remove a president from office.
Are you saying?
I'm saying that the struggle between the haves and the have-nots has been going on forever and is epidemic on your planet. It will ever be thus so long as economic interests, rather than humanitarian interests, run the world. So long as man's body and not man's soul is man's highest concern.
Well, I guess you're right. On page A14 of the same paper, there's a headline, Recession Spawns Anger in Germany. The lower headline reads, With joblessness at post-war high, rich and poor grow further apart.
Yeah, and what does this story say?
Well, it says there's great foment among the country's laid-off engineers, professors, scientists, factory workers, carpenters, and cooks. It says the nation has encountered some economic setbacks, and there are widespread feelings this hardship has not been fairly distributed.
That's correct. It has not been. Does the story say what has caused so many layoffs?
Yes, it says the angry employees are, quote, workers whose employers have moved to countries where labor is cheaper.
Aha. I wonder whether many people reading your San Francisco Chronicle on this day saw the connection between the stories on pages A7 and A14.
Ah. The story also points out that when layoffs come, female workers are the first to go.
Mm-hmm.
It says women comprise more than half of the jobless nationwide and nearly two-thirds in the East.
Of course. Well, I continue to point out, though most of you do not want to see it or admit it, that your socioeconomic mechanism systematically discriminates against classes of people. You are not providing equal opportunity, all the while you are loudly protesting that you are. You need to believe your fiction about this, though, in order to keep feeling good about yourself, and you generally resent anyone who shows you the truth. You will all deny the evidence, even as it is being presented to you. Yours is a society of ostriches. Well, what else is in the newspaper on this day?
On page A4 is a story announcing new federal pressure to end housing bias. It says federal housing officials are putting together a plan that would force the most serious efforts ever to eliminate racial discrimination in housing.
What you must ask yourself is why must such efforts be forced?
We have a Fair Housing Act which bars discrimination in housing on the basis of race, color, religion, sex, national origin, disability, or family composition. Yet many local communities have done little to eliminate such bias. Many people in this country still feel that a person ought to be able to do what he wants to do with his private property, including rent to or not rent to whomever he chooses.
Yet if everyone who owned rental property were allowed to make such choices, and if those choices tended to reflect a group consciousness and a generalized attitude towards certain categories and classes of people, then entire segments of the population could be systematically eliminated from any opportunity to find decent places in which to live. And in the absence of decent, affordable housing, land barons and slumlords would be able to charge exorbitant prices for terrible dwellings, providing little or no upkeep. And once again, the rich and powerful exploit the masses, this time under the guise of property rights.
Well, property owners should have some rights.
Yet when do the rights of the few infringe upon the rights of the many? That is, and always has been, the question facing every civilized society. Does there come a time when the higher good of all supersedes individual rights? Does society have a responsibility to itself? Your fair housing laws are your way of saying yes. All the failures to follow and enforce those laws are the rich and powerful's way of saying no. All that counts are our rights. Once again, your current president and his administration is forcing the issue. Not all American presidents have been so willing to confront the rich and powerful on yet another front.
I see that. The newspaper article says that Clinton administration housing officials have initiated more investigation of housing discrimination in the brief time they've been in office than were investigated in the prior 10 years. A spokesperson for the Fair Housing Alliance, that's a national advisory group in Washington, said the Clinton administration's insistence that fair housing statutes be obeyed was something they had tried to get other administrations to do for years.
And so this current president makes even more enemies among the rich and powerful, manufacturers and industrialists, drug companies and insurance firms, doctors and medical conglomerates, and investment property owners, all people with money and influence. as observed earlier, look for Clinton to have a tough time staying in office.
Even at this time, April 1994, the pressure is mounting against him.
Does your April 9th, 1994 edition of the newspaper tell you anything else about the human race?
Well, on page A14, here's a picture of a Russian political leader brandishing his fists. Underneath the photograph is a news story headlined, "Zhirinovsky Assaults Colleagues in Parliament." The article notes that Vladimir Zhirinovsky got into another fist fight yesterday, beating up a political opponent and screaming in his face, "I'll have you rot in jail. I'll tear your beard out hair by hair."
And you wonder why nations go to war?
Oh, man.
Here is a major leader of a massive political movement, and in the halls of parliament, he has to prove his manhood by beating up his opponents? Yours is a very primitive race, where strength is all you understand. There is no true law on your planet. True law is natural law. Inexplicable and not needed to be explained or taught, it is observable. True law is that law by which the people freely agree to be governed because they are governed by it naturally. Their agreement is therefore not so much an agreement as it is a mutual recognition of what is so. Those laws don't have to be enforced. They already are enforced by the simple expedient of undeniable consequence. Let me give you an example. Highly evolved beings do not hit themselves on the head with a hammer because it hurts. They also don't hit anyone else on the head with a hammer for the same reason. Evolved beings have noticed that if you hit someone else with a hammer, that person gets hurt. If you keep doing it, that person gets angry. If you keep getting him angry, he finds a hammer of his own and eventually hits you back. Evolved beings therefore know that if you hit someone else with a hammer, you are hitting yourself with a hammer. It makes no difference if you have more hammers or a bigger hammer. Sooner or later, you're going to get hurt. This result is observable. Now, unevolved beings, primitive beings, observe the same thing. They simply don't care. Evolved beings are not willing to play the one with the biggest hammer wins. Primitive beings play nothing else. Incidentally, this is largely a male game. Among your species, very few women are willing to play hammers hurt. They play a new game. They say, if I had a hammer, I'd hammer out justice. I'd hammer out freedom. I'd hammer out love between my brothers and my sisters all over the land.
Are you saying women are more evolved than men?
I'm making no judgment one way or the other on that. I simply observe. You see, truth, like natural law,
is observable. Now, any law that is not natural law is not observable, and so has to be explained to you. You have to be told why it's for your own good. It has to be shown to you. This is not an easy task, because if a thing is for your own good, it is self-evident. Only that which is not self-evident has to be explained to you. It takes a very unusual and determined person to convince people of something which is not self-evident. For this purpose, you have invented politicians and clergy. Scientists don't say much. They're usually not very talkative. They don't have to be. They conduct an experiment and it succeeds. They simply show you what they've done. The results speak for themselves. So scientists are usually quiet types, not given to verbosity. It is not necessary. The reason for their work is self-evident. Furthermore, if they try something and fail, they have nothing to say. Not so with politicians. Even if they failed, they talk. In fact, sometimes the more they fail, the more they talk. The same is true of religions. The more they fail, the more they talk. Yet I tell you this, truth and God are found in the same place, in the silence When you have found God and when you have found truth, it is not necessary to talk about it. It is self-evident. If you are talking a lot about God, it is probably because you are still searching. That's okay. That's all right. Just know where you are.
But teachers talk about God all the time. That's all we talk about in this program.
You teach what you choose to learn. And yes, this program does speak about me, as well as about life, which makes this program a very good case in point. You have engaged yourself in writing this because you are still searching.
Yes.
Indeed. And the same is true of those who are listening to it. But we were on the subject of creation. You asked me at the beginning of this chapter why, if I didn't like what I was seeing on earth, I didn't change it. I have no judgment about what you do. I merely observe it and from time to time describe it. But now I must ask you, forget my observations and forget my descriptions. How do you feel about what you have observed of your planet's creations? You've taken just one day's stories out of the newspaper, and so far you've uncovered nations refusing to grant basic rights to workers, the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer in the face of a depression in Germany, the government having to force property owners to obey fair housing laws in the United States, a powerful leader telling political opponents, "I'll have you rot in jail. I'll tear your beard out hair by hair," while punching them in the face on the floor of the national legislature in Russia. Anything else this newspaper has to show me about your civilized society?
Well, there's a story on page A13, headlined, "Civilians Suffer Most in Angolan Civil War." The drop head says, "In rebel areas, top guns live in luxury while many thousands starve."
Enough. I'm getting the picture. And this is just one day's paper.
One section of one day's paper. I haven't gotten out of Section A.
And so I say again, your world's economic, political, social, and religious systems are primitive. I will do nothing to change that for the reasons I've given. You must have free choice and free will in these matters in order for you to experience my highest goal for you, which is to know yourself as the Creator. And so far, after all these thousands of years, this is how far you have evolved. This is what you have created. Does it not make you indignant that you have done one good thing? You have come to me for advice. Repeatedly, your civilization has turned to God asking, "Where did we go wrong? How can we do better?" The fact that you have systematically ignored my advice on every other occasion does not stop me from offering it again. Like a good parent, I'm always willing to offer a helpful observation when asked. Also, like a good parent, I'm willing to keep loving you if I'm ignored. So I'm describing things as they really are, and I'm telling you how you can do better. I'm doing so in a way which causes you to feel some indignation because I want to get your attention. I see that I've done so.
What could cause the kind of massive consciousness shift of which you've spoken now repeatedly?
There's a slow chipping away happening. We are gradually stripping the block of granite which is the human experience of its unwanted excess, as the sculptor chips away to create and reveal the true beauty of the final carving.
We?
You and I, through our work, and a great many others, messengers all, the writers, the artists, the television and movie producers, the musicians, the singers, the actors, the dancers, the teachers, the shamans, the gurus, the politicians, the leaders, yes, there are some very good ones, some very sincere ones, the doctors, the lawyers, yes, there are some very good ones, some very sincere ones, the moms and dads and grandmas and grandpas in living rooms and kitchens and backyards all over America and all around the world. You are the forebearers, the harbingers, and the consciousness of many people is shifting because of you.
Will it take a worldwide calamity? A disaster of gargantuan proportions, as some have suggested? Must the Earth tilt on its axis, be hit by a meteor, swallow its continents whole before its people will listen? Must we be visited by beings from outer space or scared out of our minds before having sufficient sight to realize that we are all one? Is it required that we all face the threat of death before we can be galvanized to find a new way to live?
Such drastic events are not necessary, but could occur.
Will they occur?
Do you imagine that the future is predictable, even by God? I tell you this, your future is creatable. Created as you want.
But earlier, you said that in the true nature of time, there is no future, that all things are happening in the instant moment, the forever moment of now.
That is true.
Well, are there earthquakes and floods and meteors hitting the planet right now, or aren't there? Don't tell me that, as God, you don't know.
Do you want these things to happen?
Of course not. But you said everything that's going to happen already has happened, is happening now.
That is true. But the eternal moment of now is also forever changing. It is like a mosaic, one that is always there, but constantly shifting.
You can't blink, because it'll be different when you open your eyes. Watch, look.
See? There it goes again.
I am constantly changing.
What makes you change?
Your idea about me. Your thought about all of it is what makes it change, instantly. Sometimes the change in the all is subtle, virtually indiscernible, depending on the power of the thought. But when there is an intense thought, or a collective thought, then there is tremendous impact, incredible effect. Everything changes.
So will there be the kind of major earth-wide calamity you speak of?
I don't know. Will there? You decide. Remember, you are choosing your reality now.
I choose for it not to happen.
Then it will not happen. Unless it does.
Oh, here we go again.
Yes, you must learn to live within the contradiction. And you must understand the greatest truth. Nothing matters.
Nothing matters?
I'll explain that another time.
Well, okay, but I don't like to have to wait on these things.
There's so much here for you to absorb already. Give yourself some time. Give yourself some space.
Oh, can we not leave yet? I sense you're leaving. You always start talking like that when you're getting ready to leave. I'd like to talk about a few other things, such as, for instance, beings from outer space. Are there such things?
You want to know if there's intelligent life elsewhere in the universe? Yes, of course.
Is it as primitive as ours?
Some of the life forms are more primitive, some less so, and some are far more advanced.
Have we been visited by extraterrestrial beings?
Yes, many times.
For what purpose?
To inquire, in some cases to gently assist.
How do they assist?
Oh, they give a boost now and then. For instance, surely you're aware that you've made more technological progress in the past 75 years than in all of human history before that.
Yeah, I suppose so.
Do you imagine that everything from CAT scans to supersonic flight to computer chips you embed in your body to regulate your heart all came from the mind of man?
Well, yes.
Well, then why didn't man think them up thousands of years before now?
Well, I don't know. The technology wasn't available, I guess. I mean, one thing leads to another, after all, but the beginning technology wasn't there until it was. It's all a process of evolution.
You don't find it strange that in this billion-year process of evolution, somewhere around 75 to 100 years ago, there was a huge comprehension explosion? You don't see it as outside the pattern that many people now on the planet have seen the development of everything from radio to radar to radionics in their lifetime? You don't get that what has happened here represents a quantum leap? A step forward of such magnitude and such proportion as to defy any progression of logic?
What are you saying?
I'm saying consider the possibility you've been helped.
If we're being helped technologically, why aren't we being helped spiritually? Why aren't we being given some assistance with this consciousness shift?
You are.
We are?
What do you think this program is? In addition, every day, new ideas, new thoughts, new concepts are being placed in front of you. The process of shifting the consciousness, increasing the spiritual awareness of an entire planet, is a slow process. It takes time and great patience, lifetimes, generations. Yet, slowly you're coming around. Gently you're shifting. Quietly, there's change.
And you're telling me that beings from outer space are helping us with that?
Indeed. They're among you now, many of them. They've been helping for years.
Then why don't they make themselves known, reveal themselves? Wouldn't that render their impact twice as great?
Their purpose is to assist in the change they see that most of you desire, not create it.
To foster, not force. Were they to reveal themselves, you would be forced, by the sheer power of their presence, to accord them great honor and give their words great weight. It is preferred that the mass of people come to their own wisdom. Wisdom which comes from within is not nearly so easily discarded as wisdom which comes from another. You tend to hang on a lot longer to that which you've created than to that which you've been told.
Will we ever see them? Ever come to know these extraterrestrial visitors as who they really are?
Oh, yes. The time will come when your consciousness will rise and your fear will subside, and then they will reveal themselves to you. Some of them have already done so, with a handful of people.
What about the theory, now becoming more and more popular, that these beings are actually malevolent? Are there some who mean us harm?
Are there some human beings who mean you harm?
Well, yes, of course.
Some of these beings, the lesser evolved, may be judged by you in the same way. Yet remember my injunction, judge not. No one does anything inappropriate given one's model of the universe. Some beings have advanced in their technology, but not in their thinking. Your race is rather like that.
But if these malevolent beings are so technologically advanced, surely they could destroy us. What's to stop them?
You are being protected.
We are?
Yes. You are being given the opportunity to live out your own destiny. Your own consciousness will create the result.
Which means?
Which means that in this, as in all things, what you think is what you get. What you fear is what you will draw to you. What you resist persists. What you look at disappears, giving you a chance to recreate it all over again, if you wish, or banish it forever from your experience. What you choose, you experience.
Somehow it doesn't seem that way in my life.
Because you doubt the power, you doubt me.
Probably not a good idea.
Definitely not.
Why do people doubt you?
Because they doubt themselves.
Why do they doubt themselves?
Because they've been told to, taught to.
By whom?
People who claim to be representing me.
I don't get it. Why?
Because it was a way, is the only way to control people. You must doubt yourself, you see, or you would claim all your power. That would not do. That would not do at all. Not for the people who currently hold the power. They are holding the power which is yours, and they know it. And the only way to hold on to it is to stave off the world's movement towards seeing, and then solving the two biggest problems in the human experience.
Which are?
Well, I've discussed them over and over again. To summarize, then, most, if not all, of the world's problems and conflicts, and of your problems and conflicts as individuals, would be solved and resolved if you would, as a society, abandon the concept of separation, adopt the concept of visibility. Never see yourself again as separate from one another, and never see yourself as separate from me. Never tell anything but the whole truth to anyone, and never again accept anything less than your grandest truth about me. The first choice will produce the second. For when you see and understand that you are one with everyone, you cannot tell an untruth, or withhold important data, or be anything but totally visible with all others, because you will be clear that it is in your own best interests to do so. that this paradigm shift will take great wisdom, great courage, and massive determination. For fear will strike at the heart of these concepts and call them false. Fear will eat at the core of these magnificent truths and make them appear hollow. Fear will distort, disdain, destroy, and so fear will be your greatest enemy. Yet you will not have, cannot produce, the society for which you have always yearned and of which you have always dreamed, unless and until you see with wisdom and clarity the ultimate truth, that what you do to others, you do to yourself. What you fail to do for others, you fail to do for yourself. That the pain of others is your pain and the joy of others your joy, and that when you disclaim any part of it, you disclaim a part of yourself. Now is the time to reclaim yourself. Now is the time to see yourself again as who you really are, and thus render yourself visible again. For when you and your true relationship with God become visible, then we are indivisible.
And nothing will ever divide us again. And although you will live again in the illusion of separation, using it as a tool to create yourself anew, you will henceforth move through your incarnations with enlightenment, seeing the illusion for what it is, using it playfully and joyfully to experience any aspect of who we are which it pleases you to experience, yet nevermore accepting it as reality. You will nevermore have to use the device of forgetfulness in order to recreate yourself anew, but will use separation knowingly, simply choosing to manifest as that which is separate for a particular reason and a particular purpose.
And when you are thus totally enlightened, that is, once more filled with the light, you may even choose as your particular reason for returning to physical life the reminding of others. You may select to return to this physical life not to create and experience any new aspect of yourself, but to bring the light of truth to this place of illusion that others may see. Then will you be a bringer of the light. Then will you be part of the awakening. There are others who have already done this.
They have come here to help us know who we are.
Yes, they are enlightened souls, souls which have evolved. They no longer seek the next higher experience of themselves. They have already had the highest experience. They desire now only to bring news of that experience to you. They bring you the good news. They will show you the way and the life of God. They will say, "I am the way and the life. Follow me." Then they will model for you what it is like to live in the everlasting glory of conscious union with God, which is called God consciousness. We're always united, you and I. We can't not be. It's simply impossible. Yet you live now in the unconscious experience of that unification. It's also possible to live in the physical body in conscious union with all that is, in conscious awareness of ultimate truth, in conscious expression of who you really are. When you do this, you serve as a model for all others, others who are living in forgetfulness. You become a living reminder. And in this, you save others from becoming permanently lost in their forgetfulness. That is hell, to become lost permanently in forgetfulness. Yet, I will not allow it. I will not allow a single sheep to be lost, but will send a shepherd. Indeed, many shepherds will I send. And you may choose to be one of them. And when souls are awakened by you from their slumber, reminded once again of who they are, all the angels in heaven rejoice for these souls. For once they were lost, and now they are found.
There are people, holy beings, like this right now on our planet, aren't there? Not just in the past, but right now.
Mm-hmm. Always have been. Always there will be. I'll not leave you without teachers. I'll not abandon the flock, but always send after it my shepherds. And there are many on your planet right now, and in other parts of the universe as well. And in some parts of the universe, these beings live together in constant communion and in constant expression of the highest truth. These are the enlightened societies of which I have spoken. They exist. They are real. And they have sent you their emissaries.
You mean the Buddha, Krishna, Jesus were spacemen?
You said that. I didn't.
Well, is it true?
Is this the first time you ever heard that thought?
No, but is it true?
Do you believe these masters existed somewhere before they came to Earth and returned to that place after their so-called death?
Yes, I do.
And where do you suppose that place is?
Well, I always thought it was what we call heaven. I thought they came from heaven.
And where do you suppose this heaven is?
I don't know. In another realm, I guess.
Another world?
Yes. Oh, I see. But I would have called it the spirit world, not another world as we know it, not another planet.
It is the spirit world. Yet what makes you think those spirits, those holy spirits, cannot or would not choose to live elsewhere in the universe, just as they did when they came to your world?
Well, I suppose I just never thought of it that way. It's not been part of my ideas about all of this.
There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy. Your wonderful metaphysician William Shakespeare wrote that.
Then Jesus was a spaceman.
I didn't say that.
Well, was he or wasn't he?
Patience, my child. You jump ahead too much. There's more, so much more. We have another whole book to write.
You mean I have to wait for book three?
I told you. I promised you from the beginning. There will be three books, I said. The first would deal with individual life truths and challenges. The second would discuss truths of life as a family on this planet. And the third, I said, would cover the largest truths, having to do with the eternal questions. In this will be revealed the secrets of the universe. Unless they are not.
Oh, man, I don't know how much more of this I can take. I mean, I'm really tired of living in the contradiction, as you always put it. I want what's so to be so.
Then so shall it be.
Unless it's not.
That's it. That's it. You've got it. Now you understand the divine dichotomy. Now you see the whole picture. Now you comprehend the plan. Everything. Everything that ever was, is now, and ever will be, exists right now. And so, all that is. Yet all that is constantly changing. For life is an ongoing process of creation. Therefore, in a very real sense, that which is not. This isness is never the same, which means that the isness is not.
Well, excuse me, Charlie Brown, but good grief, how can anything then mean anything?
It doesn't. But you are jumping ahead again. All of this in good time, my son. All of this in good time. These and other larger mysteries will all be understood after reading book three. Unless, altogether now,
unless they are not.
Precisely.
Okay, fair enough. But between now and then, what avenues can be used right here, right now, to get back to wisdom, to get back to clarity, to get back to God? Do we need to return to religion? Is that the missing link?
Return to spirituality. Forget about religion.
That statement is going to anger a lot of people.
People will react to this entire program with anger. Unless they do not.
Why do you say forget religion?
Because it is not good for you. Understand that in order for organized religion to succeed, is to make people believe they need it. In order for people to put faith in something else, they must first lose faith in themselves. So the first task of organized religion is to make you lose faith in yourself. The second task is to make you see that it has the answers you do not. And the third and most important task is to make you accept its answers without question. If you question, you start to think. If you think, you start to go back to that source within. Religion can't have you do that, because you're liable to come up with an answer different from what it has contrived. So religion must make you doubt yourself, must make you doubt your own ability to think straight. The problem for religion is that very often this backfires, for if you cannot accept without doubt your own thoughts, how can you not doubt the new ideas about God which religion has given you? Pretty soon you even doubt my existence, which ironically you never doubted before. When you were living by intuitive knowing, you may not have had me all figured out, but you definitely knew I was there. It is religion which has created agnostics. Any clear thinker who looks at what religion has done must assume religion has no God. For it is religion which has filled the hearts of men with fear of God, or once man loved that which is in all its splendor. It is religion which has ordered men to bow down before God, or once man rose up in joyful outreach. It is religion which has burdened man with worries about God's wrath, or once man sought God to lighten his burden. It is religion which told man to be ashamed of his body and its most natural functions, or once man celebrated those functions as the greatest gifts of life. It is religion which taught you that you must have an intermediary in order to reach God. Or once you thought yourself to be reaching God by the simple living of your life in goodness and in truth. And it is religion which commanded humans to adore God. Or once humans adored God because it was impossible not to. Everywhere religion has gone, it has created disunity, which is the opposite of God. Religion has separated man from God, man from man, man from woman. Some religions actually telling man that he is above woman, even as it claims God is above man, thus setting the stage for the greatest travesties ever foisted upon half the human race.
I tell you this, God is not above man, and man is not above woman. That is not the natural order of things. But it is the way everyone who had power, namely men, wished it was when they formed their male worship religions, systematically editing out half the material from their final version of the Holy Scriptures and twisting the rest to fit the mold of their male model of the world. It is religion which insists to this very day that women are somehow less, somehow second-class spiritual citizens, somehow not suited to teach the Word of God, preach the Word of God, or minister to the people. Like children, you are still arguing over which gender is ordained by me to be my priests. I tell you this, you are all priests, every single one of you. There is no one person or class of people more suited to do my work than any other. But so many of your men are just like your nations, power hungry. They do not like to share power, merely exercise it. And they have constructed the same kind of God, a power hungry God, a God who does not like to share power but merely exercise it. Yet I tell you this, God's greatest gift is the sharing of God's power. I would have you be like me.
But we cannot be like you. That would be blasphemy.
Blasphemy is that you have been taught such things. I tell you this, you have been made in the image and likeness of God. It is that destiny you came to fulfill. You did not come here to strive and to struggle and to never get there, nor did I send you on a mission impossible to complete. Believe in the goodness of God, and believe in the goodness of God's creation, namely, your holy selves.
You said something earlier which intrigued me. Absolute power demands absolutely nothing. Is this the nature of God?
You have now understood.
I have said God is everything and God becomes everything. There is nothing which God is not, and all that God is experiencing of itself, God is experiencing in, as, and through you. In my purest form, I am the absolute. I am absolutely everything, and therefore I need, want, and demand absolutely nothing. In this absolutely pure form, I am as you make me. It is as if you were finally to see God and say, well, what do you make of that? Yet no matter what you make of me, I cannot forget and will always return to my purest form. All the rest is a fiction. It is something you are making up. There are those who would make me a jealous God. But who could be jealous when one has and is everything? There are those who would make me a wrathful God. But what could cause me to be angry when I cannot be hurt or damaged in any way? Now, those who would make me a vengeful God. But on whom would I take vengeance, since all that exists is me?
And why would I punish myself for simply creating? Or if you must think of us as separate, why would I create you, give you the power to create, give you the freedom of choice to create what you wish to experience, then punish you forever for making the wrong choice? I tell you this, I would not do such a thing. And in that truth lies your freedom from the tyranny of God. In truth, there is no tyranny, except in your imagination.
You may come home whenever you wish. We can be together again whenever you want. The ecstasy of your union with me is yours to know again, at the drop of a hat, at the feel of the wind on your face, at the sound of a cricket under diamond skies on a summer night.
At the first sight of a rainbow and the first cry of a newborn babe, at the last ray of a spectacular sunset and the last breath in a spectacular life.
I am with you always, even unto the end of time. Your union with me is complete. It always was, always is, and always will be.
You and I are one, both now and even forevermore. Go now and make of your life a statement of this truth.
Cause your days and nights to be reflections of the highest idea within you. Allow your moments of now to be filled with the spectacular ecstasy of God made manifest through you.
Do it through the expression of your love, eternal and unconditional, for all those whose lives you touch. Be a light unto the darkness and curse it not.
Be a bringer of the light.
You are that.
So be it.
Welcome to the continuation of our panel dialogue. This is Michael Toms of New Dimensions Radio, and our guests are Marianne Williamson, author of Return to Love, Raymond Moody, author of Life After Life and Reunions, and Neil Donald Walsh, author of Conversations with God.
One of the reasons that I love Conversations with God Part 2 is because it, in a way that is very unique and very new, presents a very radical political message. And I mean radical in the best sense, because I believe the truth is radical, in a way that I believe people can hear without shutting down, in fear or in denial. That's where America seems stuck to me. You know, we have a president talking about how these are the best of times, things that Conversations with God Part 2 is full of. And America has now decided to just pretend that it's not happening. But you have to look at what is before you can effectively deal with what is. And that's why I really think Conversations with God Part 2 is such a wonderful addition and contribution to the debate, because we will not be serving anyone if all we do is pour pink paint over everything and say that life is rosy.
Well, speaking of Book 2 and what you've been, all three of you have been talking about the last few minutes, regard to political and social problems that we have in society, not only in this society, but in societies all over the world, brings to mind a quote from Book 2, and I'd like to just share that with you now and have you respond to it. The quote is, "Ultimately, every geopolitical problem, just as every personal problem, breaks down to a spiritual problem. All of life is spiritual, and therefore all of life's problems are spiritually based and spiritually solved." So could each of you just take a moment to respond to that quote?
Yes, I'll respond first. It's absolutely true.
The author speaks.
As the saying goes, thank you for sharing, Neil.
There's a line in The Course in Miracles where it says that everything we do bears our own self-perception. We are saying what we think we are with everything we do. And in the world today, most everything done geopolitically bears witness to our perception of ourselves as material beings rather than spiritual beings, and economically oriented rather than relationship-oriented people. And as long as this is so, pain and suffering will be borne by millions and millions of people. And so to make the shift, to me what that line means in part is the necessity for us to make the shift from identifying ourselves to ourselves and others as purely material, economically based people, to spiritual, humanitarian, and relationship based people. And until we make that primary shift in thinking, all world conditions will, in one way or another, certainly on a large scale, reflect that mistake within our mind.
And there's another shift that's desperately important, and I use the word, I think, advisedly. And it perhaps is the first shift that has to happen that would cause the second to take place. At least that's how I see it. That shift is a shift away from thinking of ourselves as individual entities and separate beings to parts of a whole, to truly understand functionally as well as conceptually, because a lot of people say, yeah, I understand that as a concept. But to understand functionally that we are not only interdependent, but that we are in fact one. There's only one of us in the room. There's only one of us here. And when I truly understand that what is good for you is good for me and what is bad for you is bad for me, there's no way I could let 10 million of those 20 million underprivileged children go without health insurance, to use a practical example. So the shift that has to occur, and Book 2 points this out again and again and again, is the shift away from separateness, I'm over here and you're over there, to an absolute clarity and a functionality of a great wisdom. There's only one of us here.
You know, Einstein said that the idea that we are separate is merely an optical illusion of consciousness.
Absolutely. If you go back just 200,000 years, there's some one woman that we're all the direct descendant of. This has been shown by several different studies that have been conducted with mitochondrial DNA around the world. And what that means essentially is, if you think four-dimensionally instead of three-dimensionally, we are all one big, completely continuous human organism, a four-dimensional tree-like object, really, and each human being is a little bud of that larger protoplasm. And we're all in this together. Vaclav Havel, about 10 years ago, addressed the Congress of the United States, and he brought the house down with his statement that as he surveyed the world situation, he said that he felt that the only thing that can save us now is what he called a worldwide revolution in consciousness. And I think that, I mean, to me, that's just obvious. The only way out of the difficulties we find ourselves in now as a planet is to really start loving each other.
You know, one of the reasons actually that Neil and I met was because of our common interest in politics. And there is so much talk about politics in Conversations with God, Part 2. You know, Raymond, when you mentioned Vaclav Havel, it seemed very interesting to me that Americans are able to embrace a spiritually based political message if it comes from a non-American.
Yes.
Notice that. Vaclav Havel says it. We're all, oh, they're so fabulous. Nelson Mandela says it. Oh, it's oh so fabulous. But if an American says it, we have to be really alert to this. Because I know I have had some really interesting experiences where I'll say something, be damned, like it's some woo-woo, new age, fuzzy statement, and then I will say, that's interesting you think it, Mahatma Gandhi said it, or Martin Luther King Jr. said it, and the people are just, do you see what I'm saying?
Yes, as long
as they're
dead or foreign.
I think we really have to make a stand now, and I think Neil really leads the way with bringing these messages into the social and the political conversation in the United States and not letting them knock us down so easily.
Yeah, one of the things that our foundation is doing, and we're putting it together now for 1999, we're going to be putting together the International Symposium on the Integration of Spirituality and Governance. We hope that Vaclav Havel will be there, in fact, and Nelson Mandela and others as well. We hope that it will be a worldwide experience, not only taking place in one central location where the main symposium will occur, but also in hamlets and towns and villages and cities all over the world simultaneously, one weekend where spiritual and political leaders in every town, hamlet, and city on the globe will sit down at the same time and talk about ways that we can take our highest commonly held spiritual values and overlay them upon our systems of governance so that we do ask the right questions at last.
I tell you, Neil, just your saying it makes me feel really excited.
You know, Marianne, a playoff of what you were saying about not respecting those who speak of the Spirit if they're American, I'm thinking of Jimmy Carter, who appears to be more respected outside of the United States
precisely
for who he is than he is inside the United States.
Or I think also, in addition to that, we like it when he says it as long as he's not in political power anymore.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's really kind of what I mean. We really want this talk, but we don't want it in our leaders. And until we're willing to make that shift, that it's not just an ex-American leader and a South African leader, or a Czechoslovakian leader, or a Polish leader, but that it's actually an American leader saying it.
You see, the best thing Jimmy Carter did was to get out of office. And as long as he was in the White House, he was terribly ineffective, even when he did extraordinary things, like he did with Sadat and Begin, extraordinary things, and produced a miracle. People said, well, it was the wrong thing, and he didn't do it right, and he was criticized roundly. An extraordinary mirror, just as Marianne points out.
But, you know, Neil, I have some questions about that I wonder. I know on one hand he was rejected because in the United States we're still tied to this Rambo image of strength.
Yeah.
And we are more concerned about the Rambo image of strength than we are than the fact that the hostages came home alive. I understand all that. But there is another thing that I keep thinking, and of course there is no absolute answer to this, but about Jimmy Carter. It seems to me that when Jimmy Carter ran for president, he made it very clear how important God was to him. People voted for him. The country basically said, go in there with all your faith context. We'll go for it. But when he got to Washington, he stopped explaining the larger faith-based context. And I think that made him lose people more than the actions. I think sometimes the conservatives, obviously in America, need to walk their talk. But I think sometimes people with the most progressive vision need to talk their walk. And I think that Carter perhaps, and once again, there's no absolute answer to this, but it occurs to me that if perhaps he had let us in a little more on his thinking, particularly the spiritual aspects to it, as he does so freely now, he might not have lost the nation quite the way he did.
That's an extraordinary insight. I hadn't thought about it until you just said it, and I think I agree with you. I think it's absolutely true that he stopped talking about that aspect of the decision-making process because I think he felt that the system required him to. I think he had advisors saying, for heaven's sake, Jimmy, don't. For what the last thing you're going to go out there and do is say, I'm taking this action because it's right, because it's spiritually and correct, and because it's the higher consciousness thing to do.
But it's interesting because we voted for him. Basically, to me, America's vote for him as president was saying, we know you're going to do that, and we're okay with it.
Yeah. I think it's universally true now that you bring it up. I notice that it's universally true, or at least I observe it's true. We expect the highest ideas and the most grandiose concepts from all of our politicians when they're running for office. And when they get into office, we really make it difficult for them to actualize those. That's happened to more people than Jimmy Carter.
Well, I heard President Clinton once say that Mario Cuomo said that we campaign in poetry and govern in prose. Mm. And when the president said that, my comment was, yeah, well, Mario Cuomo lost. Now, if you look at someone like Ronald Reagan, he campaigned in poetry and he governed in poetry. I think that the mistake is when you begin governing in prose. Vaclav Havel governs in poetry, as does Nelson Mandela in many ways.
Yes, and although folks may not want to hear me say this, Mikhail Gorbachev.
Absolutely.
I'm sorry to say that in our society, I fear, this isn't a cynical remark, but it's just an observation that what we seem to be going through now in our society is a fad of in which anyone who is in public office or in the public eye is going to be subjected to this character assassination business. And, I think about the current difficulties of Mr. and Mrs. Clinton. Anyone I know in our socioeconomic group who's essentially ignorant about money and don't know about investments, I bet you that anybody that I know, if this huge government agency was charged with finding something you did in the past, that we'd all be in jail.
Of course, and that's why nobody in America cares about it.
That's right.
That's why he got reelected, and nobody cares. The only people who cares are the media and his opposition. Everybody else is going, what's the problem?
That's right. And so the ethos now is that what we do is that we have these public executions. We don't do it anymore like the Romans did in the arena, but we very publicly assassinate someone's character over a period of time. And it's astonishing to me that the Clintons are even walking around on 2 feet with this kind of...
Yet, even as we have spoken in these past few moments of all the things that are not going well in our country, part of me wants to make sure we don't conclude our visit without saying something about what is really hopeful and presents a new vision for tomorrow, because that's really where we need to focus our energy and focus our commentary and focus our thoughts. It's about the morrow. It's about tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow and the role we choose to play in creating the tomorrow, which we all dream and of which we know we are all capable.
There's a line in the Course in Miracles that says, look at the crucifixion, but do not dwell on it. I think that Neil is correct that we must not dwell on these things, but we must look at these things.
See, the beauty of Conversations with God, Book 2, is that it does both. It lays out the problem, but it also says, okay, folks, here is the vision. Here is the hope. Here is the way. And we as individuals need to do and say the same thing. We need to have the courage to stand up, each of us individually, and say to our families, to our communities, even to our nation, if we dare to, here is the problem, and here is the vision, and here is the hope, and here is the way. Bobby Kennedy had an enormously important thing to say, which I've carried with me all of my life. He said that some people look at things the way they are and ask why. I look at things the way they could be, and I ask why not.
It's interesting that you mentioned Bobby Kennedy because he's basically the last white liberal that really spoke in a moral context. And he's also the last white liberal that really had a piece of America's heart. So I think that there's something there about our being willing to speak politically and more specifically and practically about the conditions of the country and the world and not being afraid of doing so in a spiritual or moral context.
People think that they are powerless to provide a solution, to provide a vision. I'm here to tell you that that is not what's so, and I hope that every single person who is listening to this dialogue right now will renew their own determination to play the largest role they ever imagined they could or would play in creating and sustaining and empowering and energizing a new vision for the life of all of us. If that isn't what happens as a result of this dialogue, as a result of these books, then it's just the latest hot read, and that's just my 15 minutes in the sun, and it's got to be more than that. It's got to be more than that, or it means nothing.
The tools are there, I think, for a genuine revolution in consciousness, and personally, I'm very optimistic. I think that if you go back 1,000 years, 2,000 years, we all know that in tribal cultures around the world, there were shamans and so on who had these extraordinary powers of entering altered states of awareness. The plain fact to me is that now these are things that we're all capable of. Shamanism was an inherently closed activity, and it was kept secret by its practitioners and passed on to the next group of trainees and so on. But I think in the information age, this information is definitely going to get out, and I feel quite confident that within the next 5 or 10 years, essentially the situation will exist where all of us can be visionaries. The techniques of altering consciousness and enhancing spiritual life are widely available now and widely publicized, and I feel more and more people are taking advantage of that. I feel very optimistic.
And I'm looking for, in these days and weeks and months and years ahead, people of substance, people of power, people with great articulation skills, people who have the ability to confront the issues and formulate visions and announce and declare them, who can be very powerful in their presentations, but who can stick to the highest thoughts we all hold in common. I'm speaking, I guess, of people who are spiritually based, who are coming from a place of high consciousness, and who can step forward in the public arena and provide the kind of vision that we all need. And it's going to be difficult for people to do that, because generally the people I'm describing are people who would be, as you pointed out, Raymond, attacked, crucified by the media, and they would have apparently much to lose if you look at it from one point of view. And yet it is true that of those to whom much is given, much is asked.
Let me step in here for a moment and try and summarize and say that it seems to me that book 1 and 2 of Conversations with God and many other books and things that people are saying, like Marianne and Raymond and many others over the last 2 decades or even 3 decades, as it were, are challenging each of us to bring our spirituality into the world. That's what I hear you, all three of you, saying in these last few minutes about that what's important is not to keep it in a closet anymore, but recognizing that the Spirit is already present and is out there, that we need to, each of us in our own way, is to make the Spirit visible in our own lives and make it visible in everyone else's lives. Because if it's not visible in our lives, it can't be visible to anyone else.
And that's the bottom line message of book 2, Michael.
Absolutely. And I must confess, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, I had what I call a couch potato model of spirituality. That was something you watched in other people as and heard other people's fantastic experiences and so on. I think naturally, as we get into midlife, and tens of millions of people in the United States are now the baby boomers, there's a natural opening of spirituality. And I think our society is in a uniquely privileged position to be able to take advantage of that.
I think that there's a psychological syndrome out there. I really care, therefore I don't have to do anything. And I think that that's what we have to address now. We are beginning to see. At first, the change was from I'm not in touch with what my heart feels to we must be in touch with what our heart feels. And now the next, it seems to me, big step is that we have to go from knowing what our heart is saying to doing what our heart is telling us to do. And I think, as Neil said, that's when you really get the wheat and the chaff. The big issue is not whether or not you're in touch with your heart. The real issue is to deal with the personal risk involved in dealing with the character assassination, the public humiliation and validation that both of you were referring to that comes about if we really stand up.
We're talking here about practical spirituality.
Yeah. Earlier in the conversation, I don't know if both of you were talking, I think Raymond said something about this idea that miracles happen before and don't happen now, and that we have to counter that. I think it's not only that God it has not stopped being in process, but much like you're talking about, not only are miracles not over, prophecy is not over. And I think that there is a new prophetic voice seeking to emerge in the world today. I don't think it's a soloist. I think it's a choir. But it's time for everybody to really sing our notes and really sing our songs, because otherwise what will happen is what happened in the 60s. If it's personality-based rather than principle-based, then the old order can just kill one, two, or three leaders, and the whole impulse is stymied for a few decades.
Yes.
But if it's enough of a choir rather than just amazing soloists, then they're, you know, just getting rid of a few soloists won't stymie it anyway.
Bravo, bravo. Well said.
I'd like to say on behalf of Neil and Raymond and myself that we hope that some of the ideas that we have discussed here have opened places in your mind or awakened or resonated with thoughts that you were already thinking or that you were on the verge of thinking. And our hope is that these thoughts will serve you in opening yourself to higher modes of not only thinking but being, and walking this world in such a way as to join with all the millions of others who are desiring, as we so desire, to make this world a better place.
If we do that, if we allow these moments to be the defining moments of our life and of what we are co-creating on this planet, then these days and times and everything we do in them, every thought, every word, every action we take, will truly be a magnificent conversation with God.
Now, here is Michael Toms talking with author Neil Donald Walsh.
Neil, in book two, I noticed that certainly the latter half of the book dealt a great deal with the social and political situation and social and political issues. And one of the, I thought, provocative statements that came out of that addressing those issues was the idea of a one-world government. And I'd like you to just sort of comment on that as to what you think that means.
I think the message here is that the biggest enemy of humankind is our insistence that we are separate from each other. Separate spiritually, separate psychologically, separate politically, separate economically, and separate socially, separate in just about every way that we could possibly imagine. And it is our imagination, because we're not separate, we're imagining that we are. And the point that's being made here in Conversations with God, Book 2, in this section, is that until we divorce ourselves from that thought that we're separate and move into a realization of our unity, of our basic oneness, and then take that oneness realization and overlay it upon our systems of governance, that is to say, govern ourselves as one community. Until we do that, we will always have the clashing of interests that has produced in the past the sorry history which has been visited upon this nation. A history of wanton killing, of war, of deprivation, a history of the haves and the have-nots, a history that does not reflect even our own collective highest thought about ourselves. No human being on this planet, not a single one, I don't believe, could possibly announce or declare, much less really think, that how we've been doing things in the past several thousand years has either been effective or appropriate. And yet, knowing that it has not been effective, and in many cases has not been appropriate, we insist on clinging to our old ways. And so what the dialogue with God is saying at this point is, let's try something different. Let's try acting out in real life, in our political constructions, the truth of the matter, that there's only one of us.
And so when we begin to contemplate how we would do that, a one-world government is the obvious and natural result of such mental explorations.
Neil, this next statement that I want to read is out of the context of talking about social and political change and how to manifest it. And it's a quote from Book 2. And the quote is, "What needs to be changed is the basic nature of man. That's where the work must be done." What kind of work are we referring to here?
Well, it's deeply spiritual work, of course. It's internal work. It's work that can only begin and conclude within the deepest part of each one of us. And yet we can help each other with the work, for sure. It's the work of identifying who and what we are individually, and then, of course, collectively, and who and what we choose to be. It's the work of finally and at last agreeing with ourselves on what is right relationship with God, right relationship with ourselves, and right relationship with each other. The astonishing thing about this is we already know the answer to that. We simply don't want to functionalize it. We don't want to live it. And so we say in the depth of our being, this is what is right relationship, and then we live in a totally different way. And so the work that is being referred to here is placing into our physical reality, placing into action, if you please, the highest thoughts that we already hold. You know, when you sit down with people from all over the world, from different places and different cultures, it's amazing the level of agreement that there is in the room about these higher spiritual truths, wisdoms, and values. Virtually no one in the room disagrees about such simple, eloquent, and forceful statements as "do unto others as you would have them do unto you." It's just simply universally agreed that that is obviously and clearly how things ought to be. Having come to such universal agreement, we have chosen as a human race to ignore it. That's the astonishing thing. And so the work that has to be done is not to learn anything new. There's nothing to learn, but simply to decide at last and once and for all to live what we already know.
Neil, are you optimistic about the future?
I'm very optimistic. I'm optimistic because I believe that God is being heard now more than ever. These books, the Conversations with God books, have sold over 1 million copies. And they tell us that it'll be 5 or 10 million before the whole thing is over. And that's not a declaration of how magnificent the material is, although it is magnificent. But really, it's an announcement and a declaration. It's a noticement of the level of willingness at which people have now finally arrived, the level of willingness that we are now displaying. I'm very hopeful. I'm seeing signs all over the world. I'm hearing words spoken by people that I never heard before. And I'm seeing actions taken everywhere I look that point to a hopeful future and a better tomorrow. But we can't let up and we can't lose hope. And we must, each of us, determine to take full and individual responsibility for all of it. If we stand over here and point to the other people in the room and say, well, I can't really control that. You have to do that. You're more powerful, or you're more influential, or you have more money, or you're more something or another, and I'm not enough. If that's the position we take, then we won't get to where we need and want to go. So each of us has to take individual personal responsibility and then decide what we want to do in the space of that, whether it means simply writing a letter every day to our congressman, getting on the phone, talking to people, meditating and praying more on the spiritual side, simply participating more in the grandest question of life. Who am I and who do I choose to be?
Neil, I'm reminded of Gandhi's quote, "Be the change you want to see in the world."
It's a wonderful, wonderful statement. And of course, he would put everything I've just said here in 45 sentences into 6 words.
Neil, thank you.
Thank you. Blessed be.
Noise, the only thing that I hear sometimes. Noise, the only thing that appears sometimes. Until I turn down the sound and there's a voice I found. It whispers in my ear, it's laughing in my heart. And I'm
talking to God. Oh God, I'm talking to God. Oh good, I'm talking to God. Oh Lord, I'm talking to God. Me, why does he talk to me when I'm not especially religious, enlightened or prodigious? I'm just listening with my heart, and it blows me all apart when I find her inside of me. And I'm talking to God. Oh God, I'm talking to God. Oh good, I'm talking to God. It's coming over me. It heals with a current right up my spine. I feel like laughing and crying all at the same time. And God, oh God, I'm talking to God. I'm talking to God.